The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
Hello, and welcome again to What's Your Story? My guest this time is Bill Martin, who is the director of the Valentine Richmond History Center. And we start our program with a question that almost always prompts a conversation, Bill. What's your earliest childhood memory?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's actually one that actually shaped the rest of my life, I think, in many ways, is this appreciation for the actual experience of history. I grew up in Culpeper County, and on a piece of land that we owned, there were a whole set of canals that were part of an early navigation system that ran from Fredericksburg up the river towards Culpeper. And so we would go exploring, and we would take time. We were the only people that knew exactly where the canals were, and they still are fairly hard to find. And we would go spend Saturdays walking along, looking at the canals, looking at the work that had been done. And so it really sort of was one of the special memories, one of that place, but also of my father, who really was an important influence for me, I think.
How does that connect with the path of your life?
Well, it actually connects in two ways. One, it is a passion for being outside and enjoying the outdoors and walking. But it's also the importance of that experience. That's something you can't do from your phone or sitting at a computer. That there's something unique and important about being in a place. Mm-hmm. And so I think for the connection to here is that the Valentine is certainly an important place. It's a place that's in downtown that tells an important story of a city, of the values and the ideas that shape the city, and there's that absolute connection between ideas and place for me. And we find it in a lot of the programming that we now do. I'm not sure that we would be doing all the walking tours that we do. This past year we did 360 walking tours all over the city, from daily walking tours in Hollywood Cemetery to daily walking tours downtown. And then, of course, I always do two tours a year.
You personally?
I personally do two tours a year. We have this amazing group of guides that are much more trained and smarter than I am to do the others. But two a year I pick, and I try to go to places in the city that people don't normally go. Mm-hmm. And so to neighborhoods that are incredible historic resources that people may not go because of whatever they might have heard about. So we go to Highland Park, an amazing, amazing neighborhood, and to Barton Heights, and to walk along 25th Street out 9 Mile Road and the things that are there, and Hull Street. So there are all kinds of places that are wonderful places within the city that have important stories to tell. And it all really, I think, in many ways, and I've only just recently become aware that that's sort of the source of my need to be outside and to be walking. But it's also, it's an ability to connect that to the history of a place. And that's what we hope we can do here at the Valentine.
Let's go back to Culpeper. How long did you stay in Culpeper?
18 and out.
Oh, high school and that's it.
High school and out.
Where did you go?
I went to Tech, Virginia Tech. And so, yeah, it was an immediate, you know, and I still have family there and still go back. But it's only for visits. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that I've been in other places. I worked in a museum in South Georgia, which was really my first museum experience sort of out of college. When I was in school, the whole notion of being a museum professional mm-hmm. was really not something that was part of where I grew up. And there really weren't, actually, when you think about it, there weren't that many museum studies programs in place.
They're fairly new.
They were fairly new when I was in school. And so the whole notion of actually selecting that. And so stumbled into it. I had this undergraduate degree in architecture and urban design.
That's the appreciation of place, the architecture.
And it's it all kind of fits back together. And so there was an opportunity. I knew some folks in the small museum in South Georgia. They had the need for someone who had an architectural design background. I did a little bit of that, and really fell in love with the work of connecting that public history and understanding public history and connecting it in real ways. And so was there for a while, and then went to the Jacksonville Museum of Arts and Sciences in Jacksonville, Florida. And then before coming to the Valentine, I was in Petersburg, director of museums and tourism for a number of years. So that's the sort of trajectory of my life in terms of my profession, but I think it does all connect.
When did you study at Tech? Was it architecture?
Architecture and urban design. And then later did some graduate work in public administration. So there was this administrative side, understanding of policy, but also this commitment to good design, quality design, and the ability of using cities as places for people to talk.
So everything sort of did dovetail.
Well, it does. I will say that I am daily surprised by the life I've been given, because I can't imagine, I could never have imagined at age 18 leaving Culpeper that this is what I would be doing, but I also can't imagine doing anything else at this point. I hope folks shouldn't always think that they want to be a something, that in fact allowing yourself to be open to what comes and being willing to accept different challenges is really an important part. And I can't imagine doing anything else. Can't imagine my life without the work that I do here. But that's sort of a nice place to be. I enjoy my work, I enjoy my life, I enjoy the city. And mm-hmm. I think this institution, the commitment to, is always to be engaged in the life of the community. We changed our name actually very early on. In the 1930s, the museum actually changed its name to the Valentine, and it had a little title after it, the Museum of the Life and History of Richmond.
What was it called before that?
Just the Valentine Museum.
And that changed in the 30s?
And it changed to the Valentine, a Museum of the Life and History of Richmond. I think it's key, because it doesn't just say history. Mm-hmm. It says the life and history of a city. And so there has been this commitment over the long term of this institution to be engaged in improving the quality of life of every citizen. And so 1902, on the board, which at that point is composed of five Valentine brothers, vote unanimously to open this museum for free to every child in the Richmond public school system. That's an amazing concept. I really am not sure you can find any museum in the country that has had that long of engagement with the public schools, now 110 years. So the whole notion of the interface between schools and the museum is not a new thing. It's not something we recently discovered. And the other thing that's interesting about that is that for all of that history, we've been open to both black and white children. So that for much of Richmond's history, the Valentine Museum would have been the only place that a black child could have come to find cultural enrichment. And that's an odd thing.
It is, in a city that has always had a large black population.
The city that's always tried to define itself as black and white, and yet how do you define us in some other ways? And I think the museum has tried to do that as a community that shares a difficult but common history, that one that we all can learn from. And that's really the thing that's been astounding throughout the entire history of the institution, is there's this sense if we just know a little bit more about our history and about ourselves, we can actually do things differently the next time.
That hasn't happened in Richmond.
I think that's actually wrong.
Do you?
I absolutely do. I think that this over the last decade or two, that the folks that are mired in that old perception of the city are finally falling out. There's a friend who calls them the fossils. That in fact, when you look at the next generation in Richmond, the 20s and 30-year-olds, those issues of race are no longer relevant. And it's fascinating to watch how that is happening on this campus, with the medical campus, when you walk out of this building and walk down the street, it doesn't look like the traditional Richmond, Virginia, with just sort of the lines of black and white, with this being a public hospital, for instance.
Right.
It is, in fact, this international community. The role of immigrants and immigration to this community, not only from other countries, but from other parts of this country, has transformed the way Richmond actually, on the ground, actually works and thinks. 50% of the people who live here weren't born here. It's a different town. This is not the days. Certainly that there are social institutions that are important to the city, like the Como Club and the Country Club of Virginia, and certainly that's part of the life of the city. But much of what's going on in this community is outside of those sort of traditional institutions and sort of the traditional structure, the structure that we've always thought was the way Richmond does things. And so when you talk to someone who's moving to Richmond, if you just talked to them 20 years ago, they would have said, oh, this is the most horrible place, you know, it's such a closed. And that's not the case. The people that are moving to Richmond now think it's the most amazing place, and they don't get why there are some of us that still are mired in this old way of thinking about what this city is. I mean, look at my board. My board of 24, there are only a couple that were actually born, raised, lived in Richmond. It's the people that have moved to town that actually have this deeper appreciation for the richness of its history, and who are not afraid to come downtown to go to dinner. And so I really don't agree. I think that the needle has moved, and I think some of us, you know, that have missed it, that the community has changed, and groups of people that don't realize that it's sort of like the water in the boiling pot. Mm-hmm. The fish is cooked and he doesn't even know it. And we need to make sure that as an institution that we're connecting with a very different view of life in the city and how it is structured. And that's a big challenge because it changes the way you look at donors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly there are, all of our cultural institutions benefit from this really wonderful tradition of families who have given a lot over a long term to the Valentine, to the VMFA, to the Historical Society, to Maymont, all these great things that are now the legacy institutions. But that world has changed, and how do we begin to engage a new generation and a much larger generation of individuals that are new to town, new corporations have come? I don't think you can underestimate the impact of Capital One, of Altria, of Midwest Acorn, all bringing in very different ideas. But how do we connect these new folks? Those folks that have been supporters for years, their families have been here for hundreds of years, and they're supporting these institutions because it's always been a part of Richmond. How do you convince that new person, the person who's moved here from Dayton or from New York, that this place is relevant, but won't necessarily see their history here because they're from Dayton? We're Richmond. And so how do you begin to make connections with new generations? One of our initiatives with our strategic plan is that there will be major collecting initiatives here in the Hispanic community, so that, you know, we will be collecting objects along Hull Street and to make sure that we reflect the changes that are occurring in Chesterfield County and Southside, but also documenting what's happening with the changing demographics of the city on the East End, with large numbers of African Americans moving into Henrico County. And how do we document that and make sure that we document those stories? And so one of our favorite things that have just been recent added to the collection is the first Mexican restaurant in Richmond went out of business. The family closed the business just a few years back.
What was the first? I don't mean to stump you, but I'm curious.
La Fiesta?
La Fiesta on Brook Road.
No.
Or on Hull Street.
On Hull Street.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I remember that.
Or La Siesta. La Siesta. No, I can't remember.
I can't remember.
It's horrible. I'm going to be in so much trouble.
All right.
But they called and said, we're closing the business. And one of our great collections came from there. We have the tea room from Miller and Rhodes. We have tables and menus and all those things. We have a booth from wonderful restaurant that was in Jackson Ward at Neverett's. And then, so here comes this opportunity. Now we have a table and chairs and menus and paintings and all kinds of wonderful things from this from a Mexican restaurant. So we begin to make sure that we can create in the future, through our collections, these real connections to families and their histories. Certainly we have wonderful things related to early families in Richmond and in Virginia, wonderful decorative arts, but those decorative arts don't stop in 1900. That Richmond history, despite what a few folks would think, did not stop with the Civil War. I had a wonderful board chairman when I first came here, and he was one of those great families, and he would always say, not all history happened on River Road.
Right.
That's the challenge that creates some interest around here. It's how do you tell a bigger story?
And it's a big story to tell.
It's a big story.
I want to tell people where we are. We're sitting in a conference room and looking out on Clay Street. Tell me about the buildings, about the physical buildings of the museum.
We now own the 1100 block of Clay Street. So there are a series of older historic buildings. One, the first building certainly on the block is the 1812 Wickham House, built by John Elizabeth Wickham, when, in fact, across the street there would have been nothing. This would have been the outer limits of a city, and you would have looked out of their window into Chaco Creek and Chaco Valley. Kind of astounding to think about. But this house is celebrating its 200th birthday this year, and really was this radical house.
So.
Well, I think it would have the same effect of going into a Frank Lloyd Wright house. I mean, it would have today. It was this very different view of how people lived. You know, two blocks away, actually a block away, is John Marshall's house. This sort of traditional, closed-in, colonial house. Rooms that have varieties of functions that are fairly modest in size. And you come next to this house and suddenly you have bright colors and beautiful wall hangings and wall paintings. And furniture that has gold, and it's a pretty flashy house. And each room has its own special function, and really this very, very elaborate and high-style house being built in Richmond at a time when there were only 10,000 people, which is hard to imagine. In 1812, here's Virginia, the largest of the states, probably the most economically influential, politically certainly the most influential, with most of the presidents coming from Virginia. Here we have this town of 10,000. And they had ambitions, and so they expressed it in the buildings that they were building, from Jefferson's Capitol to Robert Mills' monumental church to Paris's house for the Wickhams and for the governor of Virginia. So, one house. Then there was a series of row houses built in the years before the Civil War that were purchased by the museum in the late 1920s and added into the complex. Next on the block is the Branford Cecil House, which has moved here. It was actually, its original location was right next to Second Presbyterian Church, and it was moved here in the 50s. And then this house on the corner, the Davis House, where we're doing our interview today, was built in the 1880s by Decatur Davis, a great Second Empire Victorian house that is now where all of our offices are. So we now have the entire block. The other thing that's important for people to know is, yes, we do have parking.
Ah, okay.
Because it's always the question, well, all that's very wonderful, but where am I going to park? We are very fortunate that we do have our own, while it's small, parking lot that provides for visitors to the museum free parking. And I think if anyone drives in and tells their attendant they're here as a visitor, he will find you parking. So one other thing, we also have Sally Bell. Sally Bell's kitchen is our, we have a cafe in our garden. So if you are in need of a cupcake and a deviled egg and potato salad, that's also here.
And the cupcake will have a little walnut on top of it.
Right.
Yeah. Sally Bell goes back a long ways. We are talking with Bill Martin, who is the director of the Valentine Richmond History Center, and we've talked about the building, Bill, but tell me what's in it. What will people see when they come here?
What an amazing resource. And we now have, in the last 7 years, completed the first complete inventory of the collection.
Really? It's taken that long?
Well, there are 1.5 million objects.
Are they all here?
We have off-site storage, but our costume and textile collection, which is one of our signature collections, is here, documenting the entire fashion textile history of Virginia from the beginning to today. One of the largest photography collections, from the really the beginning of photography.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the earliest known photograph of Richmond, taken in the 1850s, late 1850s, to digital photographs that are being taken today that are being added to the collection that document all of that. So that's here. And then the decorative arts and paintings and all the other things. And so on any given day, what are our curators deciding needs to be out? Currently, we have a history of the museum, as told from the really sort of the view of the Valentine family, a small exhibit that's sort of an introduction to Richmond history, and then a third gallery that changes. And we made the decision a few years back that we weren't going to do the Civil War, and that that was an opportunity, because everyone else is doing the Civil War, that we wanted to look at Richmond in the 20th century. And so there have been a series of exhibitions, starting with an exhibit on race, on the politics of race in Richmond in the 1950s and 60s, and that was open as Obama was being elected, so it was kind of an interesting. The second exhibition in this cycle was on the Great Depression in Richmond, and it opened just as the Great Recession was beginning. It was very timely. There are lots of lessons to be learned from Richmond in the 1930s versus Richmond today that we thought were important. And then the current is looking at personal sacrifice during times of war, and it looks at World War I and World War II. And really, I think, in a very subtle ways, I think, makes the case that the wars that we are currently fighting are that, in fact, as a country, we have, other than those who have soldiers fighting, that as a country, we have very little personal sacrifice, mm-hmm. that we're not growing our own food, we're not saving, there are no rationing, that there's really no individual sacrifice associated with this war and the wars that we're in. And so it's a really intriguing view of, particularly looking at the important role that women played in both World War I and World War II on the home front, mm-hmm. that the role of women is often ignored when we think about wars and the impact of war. And I think that's part of who we are. It's making sure that we tell that balanced story that remembers that there are other people that are part of the stories that are not always the ones who get their paintings on the wall.
Mm-hmm. There's a story I want you to tell, and we've got maybe 5 minutes left. The story of Valentine meat juice.
Oh my God, yes. Well, that's the source of everything you see.
It is.
It is. One of the Valentine brothers, one of our founding brothers, wife was ill. Well, the story is, and he went in the basement, cooked up this stuff. She drank it. It did wonders.
Didn't kill her.
Didn't kill her. And evidently she told all of her friends that it was this great thing. And so he began producing it in larger and larger quantities.
Which Valentine was this? Do you remember?
Man, I think. It was
Man Valentine?
Yeah,
and this would have been early 20th century?
Late 19th.
Because it was around forever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, they continued. The manufacture continued into the 60s. But this product, the actual original plant for this was located on Capitol Square. The Valentine's house was on the corner of 9th and Broad.
Mm.
And so the original manufacturing operation and home, because they were also in the retail business, they started in dry goods. They were mm-hmm. a dry goods business on Broad Street. So this product was made there until it really became much more sophisticated. The process changed a little bit. And the factory was moved out of downtown where they could have stockyards so that they'd have a ready source of cattle for the process of making meat juice, which was basically, I think, in many ways sort of a concentrated beef bouillon.
But they made a fortune out of it.
Well, and it was sold all over the world and was a very popular product. I think it's certainly at some point in time there are problems with it being sold as a curative, and became, it was actually as an additive, as a flavoring.
Mm-hmm.
And so it continued to be sold in Europe as a flavoring, and it was sold locally. I think, you know, there are individuals that continue to tell me that it was the secret ingredient for the Bloody Marys at the Commonwealth Club.
But that's where the Valentine name comes from in Valentine Richmond History Center.
Absolutely. They were the founders and gave this museum to the city in 1892.
Mm-hmm.
For public education. It was certainly about the collection, but again, it was really about the educational mission.
What do you see as the future of the Valentine Richmond History Center? You're collecting, which people don't realize, I'm sure, that you're still collecting, because there are generations and generations to come, knock wood, that will be able to enjoy this museum and will want to know what the early 21st century was like.
And deciding what to collect is really, I think, one of our challenges, and we talked a little bit about it, is making sure that as we collect, it provides this rich resource that is a diverse resource for our future curators to pull from. So in each collecting area, we're looking at what story do we want to tell. It's not just about the finest and most beautiful. And that's the difference between a history museum and an art museum, is that we're really much more interested in, does it give us the ability to tell a story, an important story about Richmond? And so that's one of our challenges. I think the impact of technology is important, and we are certainly looking at increasing our online presence so that people who want to do research can do that online. But I'm going to tell you, it comes back to our original conversation. It's still about coming to a place and experiencing a personal experience in a place where things happened. And so whether it's on our walking tours or whether it's walking through the galleries here, it's not about how much technology you have. It's about, here we are, we're in a real place, in a real city, and here are the real things that tell us about the lives of Richmonders who came before us.
And we'll tell future generations
about our
lives.
Exactly.
Bill, thanks for being our guest on What's Your Story? Bill Martin is the director of the Valentine Richmond History Center. And I'm Don Dale, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice for What's Your Story?
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477. And be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.